and surpassed penetrating and perfect Dharma is rarely met with even 100,000,000,000 kalpas, having it to see and listen to remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Was it hot here yesterday? I was up in Sacramento doing a wedding and it was like 105. I couldn't believe it. I thought, maybe this is why meditation developed in India, you know? Couldn't do anything, man. Just sit there and watch things. Too much effort to move. Yeah, we were doing the wedding there, you know, three different layers of robes. I didn't think we were going to make it through the ceremony. Oh, hot. So I wanted to, I've got about 20 koans, there's 1,800 Zen koans, and there's probably about 20 that are, you know, pretty profound. So I'm going to keep coming back and visiting them. I like them a lot. I think they have a lot to say. And they're actually, I'm beginning to see the similarity between the Lojong, the Tibetan Lojong teachings that also I'm going to go back and, you know, revisit with you. And so I was, somebody at the wedding party, I said, well, what do you do in Sacramento? We only have about 3 hours here in the morning before we get out of the heat. She said, oh, we should go to the Capitol building and just walk around the Capitol. Has anybody walked around the Capitol in Sacramento? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Fabulous. I couldn't believe it. I've never been there all these years. You know, I just go through Sacramento. I never stop. And so it's an arboretum. You could go and see all these trees, but they're spectacular. I mean, you know, they're really kind of these full-grown trees. One of the trees was a huge magnolia, and the blossom was about this big. I couldn't believe how beautiful this blossom was. So I even took a picture of it with my little iPhone. And so I was thinking about the koan we had a couple weeks ago about Buddha and Mahakashapa. The Dharma was just twirling the flower, and how elegant that is, that the whole talk, you know, about form and emptiness, and that we find emptiness right here in this world, in this very earth that we walk on. And a flower, we start with a flower because it's pretty easy to see it, maybe with a flower and a bee crawling across the pollen. And then we can begin to extend that out to everything. So I have that on my front page of my iPhone now, you know, this magnolia flower. So have you seen anything like that helps you see the whole world, you know? Maybe it's Venus, a sunset, or just maybe the air in the morning, early in the morning when it's warm. And you begin to feel, you know, how everything's okay. The kind of perfection of the universe. Emptiness in form, everything included in that one moment. And then the second koan we did the next week, which was about the Hakujo and the Fox, by Jean and the Fox, about how, you know, the guy was didn't have a very good incarnation. He used to be the abbot, and he said, they asked me, you know, thought I was doing the right thing, if I just work on my greed, hate, and delusion, and purify myself, then I'm going to step out of bad karma. I thought that was the right answer. And I got, he getting reincarnated as a fox. I was telling me I didn't quite have it. And Baijong says, the enlightened person embraces karma. And he got it. You know, he got it at that point. He got it that he could stop struggling. He stopped struggling. He could just be. And so that's such a profound teaching. And I was thinking about in the Lojong teachings, probably the first one with Bodhidharma trilling the flower. That's the 7 points of mind training, you know, then 52 subcategories. And the first point of mind training is really that kind of try to see the absolute. How do you bring the absolute into focus in your everyday life? And then I was by Zhang and the Fox is more the third point, which is use the difficulties of your life to wake up. Really what he's saying. You know. Stop struggling. You know, we sit on our cushion and we want to just step out of this personality we have. You know, this limited way. We know there's some way we can be more than we are. So Suzuki Rishi used to say all the time, you know, and we didn't quite get it. We were kind of young and I'm not sure we didn't like ourselves so much. I think it's just we wanted to be super, you know, like super enlightened. And that's what was really enticing to us. And he kept saying, no, just, you're fine just the way you are. You're fine. We said, no, we're not fine just the way you are. No, you're just fine. You know, and then he would say, which was a little more helpful, he'd say, you're fine just the way you're perfect just the way you are. And you can use a little work. He'd say great things like, he'd say, I look at you, I think you're all Buddhas until you open your mouth. So maybe that was a little bit like that, you know. So I was also thinking about Hakaju and the Fox, how much it's like a serenity prayer. You know, it's like both sides, really. It isn't just that one side embracing. The first part of the answer is right, too. We have to work on the precepts. Like part of the main part of the wedding ceremony is really the precepts. You know, I said we can do the ceremony any way you want to do it. I said, but the only thing that we need to do is have the precepts in it. And it was people in the audience, they weren't Buddhists. You know, most of them weren't Buddhists. There were some, but not too many. And so a lot of people came up and said, wow, that was amazing. Those precepts are just incredible. Really, this one black guy came up, you know, and he said, man, that was just had so much spirit in it. I just felt it. So that was inspiring. But I was thinking about the serenity prayer, you know, about Hakujo and the Fox. So maybe the first part of the koan is that we really do need to work. We need to practice the precepts. We do need to get our act cleaned up. And so change those things we can change. But the second, but that doesn't quite do it because we're always on the treadmill. You know, change, got to change, it's not right. The world is a veil of tears. So the second part, Akajo, is saying, and accept those things, just be with those things. So we spend a lot of time on our cushion, not trying to change things, just to be with it. So we really, it's an act of submission, really, an act of emptying. And when we first start to sit our meditation practice, it really is, I think, we're trying to change. And then it begins to dawn on us that if there is some change that happens, it happens by just being with. And I was thinking this morning that early Buddhism, you know, really was, you know, Buddhist said, he started off by saying, well, there's suffering, which means things change. And because we don't want things to change, there's suffering. We die. We don't like we don't like those kinds of changes. And so we practice, and there's a strong emphasis on, you know, just eliminating greed, hate, and delusion. That's what a lot of the practice was, a lot of your ascetic practices. But then when it began to move up into China and Buddhism began to be deeply influenced by Taoism, it had a little different take. It was a little more of a mellowing And it was more like, you know, the Tao, the way. Just be with things as they are. See the beauty of things, the perfection of things as they are, even the things that don't feel that way. So it was a more sophisticated way of looking at things. Not to ignore the first part, but more of a deepening. You know. So we start, you know, my favorite phrase, you know, by Dogen is, we study ourselves. We study how the mind actually works. We study those things, how we contract. We study ourselves. And then we begin to kind of forget ourselves. You know, we get so wrapped up in ourselves, you know. And we actually do experience places where we just kind of, we aren't there. We're just our ears and eyes and touch and taste. And we're not so concerned with evaluating all that, you know. We forget ourselves. And then all things advance forward. And we sit. We're able to sit and just let things advance forward and touch us. The magnolia blossom on the tree. And we do this, you know, many traditions, they talk a lot about the watcher. You know, before we're just lost in our thought. We just think we are our thoughts. But then we begin to develop the capacity and say, if that's a useful term, can be a useful term, called the watcher, where you begin to watch. You're watching yourself, right? Well, that's interesting. This is how I'm thinking. Oh, I'm thinking now. Oh, I'm thinking these thoughts now. You know. But that's a little bit limited because you can become kind of self-conscious. It's almost like when you're doing the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, you can really get in and watching the body and the sensations of the body. And if you're not careful, you can almost get to be able to kind of like a hypochondriac. That's what a hypochondriac does. You know, really tuned in too much to all the things that are happening. So the watcher is useful, but the more you develop practice, the more the watcher recedes a little bit. You're not, because it's there's still some element of the self, you know, big self in that process. So I haven't actually gone through this sequence, but often when I teach meditation practice, and I haven't given this to you for a while, but this is, I thought that this was often away. So we use kind of what we call pious, skillful means. So the watcher can be kind of skillful until we can let that abate a little bit. When I'm teaching, you know, meditation, we start, and I, you know, you start with, okay, well, how do you stabilize? How do you just bring yourself to the present moment? You know, and so you start maybe with counting. That's very useful to do that, to just start to count. Maybe to 5 to start off with, and maybe to 10 on the out-breaths, counting. And then maybe you can, and actually when I started practice, I've told you this many times, you know, for 5 years that was my main practice. I just tried to count, you know, that Sudhirji just said beginning practice, middle practice, advanced practice. Just count. It's right there. Then we begin to change, we begin to study others and teachers, and we realize they said, no, you can kind of drop counting. So then we begin, you know, just to fine-tune it a little. Okay, how about just really paying attention to beginning, middle, and end, and then space at the end, and then beginning of the exhale, the middle of the exhale, the end. You know, if you really, your meditation gets refined, you'll see, you know, the instructions are don't try to slow your breath down or just be with it and your breath will naturally start to slow down. But you'll notice that actually when your concentration is pretty good, you're not having very many breaths. I mean, you can use that as a technique too. Try to just have 3 breaths in a minute and really follow the breath, you know, kind of more intentionally. Beginning, middle, and end of the inhale, beginning, middle, and end. So that's kind of the second place. And then the third place is where you're not following, you just are the breath. You just become the breath. And then another stage would be where you just even drop the breath. You just are. So this is the kind of experience that is hard. If you're lucky, maybe, you know, you can experience this 10 minutes, sitting 10 minutes a day, eventually, not every 10 minutes, but you will get to that place where you can kind of feel these different places. But that's why sitting longer retreats is kind of helpful. You sort of have to exhaust some of your karma in some ways, or you have to just submit, you know, you're through the restlessness and you struggle, and there's something in that struggle where you just submit and you just give up, and then you can some of what I'm talking about here comes to you. It's a little like, you know, at first I think it's helpful to try to maybe really watch the mind and try to create those gaps between your thinking. You know, one Tibetan teacher said in his instruction in meditation was, see if you can just make a gap bigger between your thoughts. But there's a little bit element of control there, but that's actually helpful. Again, it's kind of a useful way to do that in meditation sometimes, where you're trying to go for the gap and not the thought. But if you do that, eventually you'll come back to what Dogen says, which is think non-thinking. You want to get to the place eventually where you're familiar enough with your mind where the thoughts aren't bothering you so much. You know, you're aware of them, but you don't have to control them. You know, it's not like, okay, meditation, good meditation is no thoughts. You know, bad meditation is lots of thoughts. Meditation gets beyond that process. So I've been reading this book. Did you get it, Susan?
Oh, I didn't get it.
You didn't get it yet, huh?
Yeah.
So this is on the New York Times bestseller. This is by Ruth Seki, who's a practitioner, Zen practitioner, and what she says. And I know her a little bit. And so time being, right? So time being, a tale for time being. So that's taken on about from Dogen's fascicle in the Shobha Genzo on time being. It's about time being. Like this moment includes the past and the present. That's why we keep emphasizing the now. This moment includes the past and the present. So it's a very sweet tale. Well, sweet. I don't know. I'm enjoying the book a lot. I've still got about 20 more pages, so I don't actually know how it ends, which will be kind of interesting. But it's about a young girl, she's about 16, and it's told in a very kind of humorous 16-year-old way, and she's Japanese. Her father came to Sunnyvale during the dot-com explosion and was very successful, and then everything crashed, mostly because he was working with the defense industry designing software for the day, and he began to not like what he was doing. And so he was sort of blacklisted, and then the crash, and he goes back to Japan, and they're having this horrible time. And his young daughter, 16-year-old daughter, who's mostly American at this point, just has this horrible time. They're picking on her in school, and he gets suicidal, and she gets a little suicidal. And I mean, it sounds kind of grim, but actually, the way to tell the story, there's a lot of humor in it also. And then it's, I don't want to tell you the whole thing, but anyway. So then there's another character who lives on Cortez Island, which is up in Vancouver. I went there a couple of years ago, and that's where Ruth actually lives. So a lot of this is actually, can't tell how much it's about the real Ruth or not, but this person picks up a freezer bag that floated in on the beach, and she's reading the diary of this young girl. And you're not quite sure how she put it in, but then it starts going back and forth. The time sequence begins to merge, and you often don't know what time you're in. And the person who's in Cortez, who's also Japanese, is really trying to relate to the 16-year-old girl. And the 16-year-old girl, she meets her grandmother, her great-grandmother, who is a 103-year-old Buddhist nun. So this whole through the whole thing are interspersed these kind of Zen teachings, you know. So it's really kind of incredibly creative book and very interesting to read. Not difficult to read. So I thought I'd read to you the 16-year-old girl, so she's pretty depressed, right? She goes to stay in this monastery, and her great-grandmother says, well, you need some help. You need some help. And one of the things, you just hang out with me in the monastery and just kind of help me, you know, help around this old rickety monastery. And she says, but you need to develop some superpowers. You know, it's kind of a skillful way, you know. Only she calls it in the Japanese, so superpower. Develop a superpower. And the superpower is zazen. So here's the 16-year-old girl giving zazen instructions. She's writing this. She says, I don't know who this is going to read this eventually, but I just want to tell you this zazen is really pretty cool. And so I'm going to tell you what my grandmother, how she taught zazen. So here's how the 16-year-old girl who's just starting to practice zazen. Okay. First of all, you have to sit down, which you're probably doing already. The traditional way is to sit on a zafu cushion on the floor with your legs crossed, but you can sit on a chair if you want to. The important thing is just to have good posture, not to slouch or lean on anything. Now, you can put your hands in your lap and a kind of stack them up so that the back of your left hand is on the palm of your right hand and your thumb tucks come around and meet the top, making a little round circle. The place where your thumbs touch could line up with your belly button. Jiko, that's her great-grandmother, who's a pretty cool person, actually, says this way of holding your hands is called a Hokai Juin, which means cosmic circle, right? And it symbolizes the whole cosmic universe, which you are holding up on your lap like a great, big, beautiful egg. Next, you try to relax and hold really still and concentrate on your breathing. You don't have to make a big deal about it. It's not like you're thinking about breathing, but you're not thinking about it either. It's kind of like when you're sitting on the beach and watching waves lapping up on the sand or some little kids you don't know playing in the distance. You just notice everything that's going on, both inside and outside you, including your breathing and the kids and the waves and the sand. And that's basically it. It sounds pretty simple. But when I first tried to do it, I got really distracted by all my crazy thoughts and obsessions. And then my body started to itch. And it felt like there were millipedes crawling all over me. When I explained this to Jiko, she just told me to count my breaths like this. Breathe in, breathe out, one. Breathe in, breathe out, two. She said I should count like this up to 10. And when I got to 10, I could start all over again. I'm like, no problem, Jiko. And I'm counting away when some crazy revenge fantasy against my classmates or a nostalgic memory of Sunnyvale pops into my mind and totally hijacks my attention. As you probably figured out by now, on account of my ADD, my mind is always chattering away like a monkey, and sometimes I can't even count to 3. Can you believe it? Can you believe it? No wonder I couldn't get into a decent high school, when the good news is that it doesn't matter if you screw up in zazen. Jiko says don't even think about it as screwing up. She says it's totally natural for a person's mind to think, because that's what minds are supposed to do. Or when your mind wanders and gets tangled up in your crazy thoughts, you don't have to freak out. It's no big deal. You just notice it's happening and drop it. Like, whatever. And start again from the beginning. 1, 2, 3, etc. That's all you have to do. It doesn't seem like such a great thing, but Jiko is sure that if you do it every day, your mind will wake up and you will develop your superpower. I've been pretty diligent so far, and once you get the hang of it, it's not so hard. What I like is that when you sit on your Zafu, or even if you don't happen to have a Zafu handy, for example, say if you're on a train or on your knees in the middle of a circle of kids who are punching you or getting ready to tear off your clothes, she has this experience in school actually. In other words, no matter where you are, you return your mind to Zazen. It feels like coming home. Maybe this isn't a big deal for you because you've already got a home. But for me, who never had a home except in Sunnyvale when I lost it, it's a big deal. Zazen is better than home. Zazen is a home that you can't ever lose. Zazen is a home that you can't ever lose. And I keep doing it because I like that feeling. And I trust old Jiko. And it wouldn't hurt for me to try to see the world a little more optimistically, like she does. Jiko says that you do Zazen to enter time completely. Tale for time being. To enter time completely. I really like that. Here's what old Zen Master Dogen, he keeps coming in a little bit. Her uncle was a kamikaze pilot. And there's another diary that he writes about his experience. And he discovers the Dogen's teaching and how that influences him. Here's what old Zen Master Dogen has to say about it. Think non-thinking. How do you think non-thinking? Non-thinking. This is the essential art of Zazen. I guess it doesn't make a whole lot of sense unless you just sit down and do it. I'm not saying you have to do it. I'm just telling you what I think.
May our intentions equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.
So,
I have a question. Not long ago, I picked up the Shobogenzu and that part about time being.
Yeah.
And I found that really rough going. I thought maybe it was a translation or something, but the words were there, and I understood the words, but I just couldn't grasp it. Very challenging. I was wondering, is there a particular translation of that that you like, or maybe exegesis or something that explains it more, or would go in the treatment?
What do you think about time being, Bob?
I sort of agree with Bob. I probably read it about four or five times, and a little bit more each time, comes through. But your comment about that the current moment contains the past and the present, that's there. Also, I think part of what I read in it is that some of what Einstein writes about time being another dimension. Being another measurement, it's almost, I want to go back and pull out quantum physics stuff, because I think he's dabbling in that sort of thing too.
Yeah.
I think the the when you talk about the translation, the Kaz Tanahashi's translation is easier for me to read than there's another one, I forget the guy's name, starts with N. But it really is one that I keep going back to, and I think, well, I hope I'll get this one of these times. Okay, closer, I think.
Well, it's probably his most challenging. And Dogen's not easy to read, you know. I mean, you have to have a certain taste for it, and you get really frustrated with it. Just like a lot of the Koans are sort of that way, you know. The idea is if it's simple, you know, it's Zen to a fault probably likes to make you work really hard, you know, to kind of get it. But if you work with it, you know, if you stay with it, with his language. And, you know, I know people that are Dogen scholars have been really helpful with me. They said, you know, sometimes I think he didn't want you to understand it. You know, it's like, I mean, clearly they didn't quite, you don't quite get it either. You know? So it's probably time for me to spend some time on it and give a Dharma talk in the time being. I've had that same experience. It's probably why I haven't, probably because the reason I haven't given a talk. I'm a little intimidated by it. So
I'm thinking if you knew, maybe if I studied medieval Japanese, and I could read medieval Japanese, I would have a better.
Bob, read this. No, because it explains it a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, since you've read Kind Being, because it's starting to go back and forth. I mean, basically, you know, what it's about is it's about emptiness. It's about how all of us, everything that's happened in the past affects us now. And everything that we're doing now will affect everything in the future. I mean, that's what he's trying to get us to see in Time Being. Time Being in this present includes all of us. To get us to begin to not take the present moment for granted and the interconnectedness of time. So it's very profound what he's saying. You know.
Yeah.
And so this is very humorous in a very sweet way. I mean, the woman on Cortez Island begins to intersect and affect the life of this, you know, this young girl in Japan. How does she do that? How's that possible? You know. And anyway, it begins to get you to kind of question that in a way. So let's hold that, and I'll thank you for the encouragement to look further into that. Okay.
I often run into this thing about presence and present moments, and I could be wrong, of course. More and more seeing there is no present moment. There's no moment. There's presence. There's a now. This is what keeps coming up. It's now. There's no present moment. I mean, the idea of a moment, I think maybe I felt there might be something really wrong with the idea of the present moment. There is no moment. There's that's just.
By the way, the name. Well, that's
sorry,
true.
As a discrete something other than you.
Yeah, I guess it sounds like you're beginning at an end of a moment.
Well, I mean, you're breaking down into a trillionth of a second, or that, or now a second. But it's sort of, there is no moment.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that's true. And
you know, Gary Snyder has a little poem. One of the shorts says, "This moment becoming eternity."
Yeah,
is that it?
Yeah. Can you say that again?
This moment becoming eternity.
Right. By the way, the name of the 16-year-old girl is now.
Yeah.
That's your name. N-A-O. Now. That's your name. Now. Cool.
That's interesting. That's a male name, too. There's a Nao Noguchi here in town.
Oh.
Japanese.
Oh. Okay. Thank you. Don't forget to help Carolyn sign up. She's always the one that's here helping me set up chairs. So
well,
help her out a little bit.
Also, the beach cleanup.
Interesting.
Yeah.
What's the name of this book?
What's the name of it?
Mm-hmm.
Time Being.
tail for the time being.
Oh, for the
interesting.
Time.
did you take it out? It's what does this? What does this modify? Thank you for telling us about it. I'm going to use that next time I get a chance from my book. I'm in a book group.
Yeah, Trisha,
I'm going to make everybody read
Trisha,
that.
Well, you should read it. You know, because again, it's like a lot of guys don't like the. Often women writers, you know, they write from a woman's perspective. I think it's very sweet. Trish would probably like
it. I'm going to write it down. I'm going to get it.